It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
As we gather to celebrate the holidays, it's also time to remember those less fortunate. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In the United States, more than 500,000 people spent the night either sleeping outside or in emergency or transitional shelter. That's nearly 565,000 to be exact for January of 2015. For the state of Maryland, the Department of Housing and Urban Development found that homelessness actually declined by 8% between 2015 and 2016, but that drop was preceded by a 7% uptick for the year before. As we emerge from the Great Recession, this community is still in need. In our studios, Sister Virginia from Joseph House, and she is from, of course, Salisbury, and also Claudia Nagel, who is director of Diakonia, which provides housing, food, and counseling for those in need, and also with her, who works with her, Anna O'Neill. Hopefully later on, we will be joined by Jim Barnes, who oversees the Christian shelter in Salisbury. Welcome to the program, first of all.
Good morning.
Let me turn to you, Claudia, and say, I just mentioned a moment ago that the Maryland folks say that homelessness is down, but then that's after homelessness was up. What are you seeing in your part of town?
We're seeing a consistent number of people who are in need of housing, emergency housing, as well as assistance to maintain their housing. So we haven't really seen a dip in the demand for our services, whether that's emergency food assistance, rental assistance, our veterans program. The need is very consistent.
So are we seeing any kind of difference in terms of people that are seeking assistance? Has that changed over the years? I know we've come out of this great recession. That is that a lot of people who, for instance, wound up homeless or seeking aid because they were out of a job. Suddenly we were losing something like 750,000 jobs a month at one point in 2009. Are we seeing now that changing, that composition changing, or are we seeing something just simply consistent people in terms of people who are working for
work? We've seen an uptick in families, the number of families with children.
And that's still true.
And it's still true. One of the challenges that we face in our area is that the seasonality of employment. And employment that pays a wage where folks can afford housing and the other expenses. Most of our guests, or the folks who stay with us at Diakonia temporarily in our emergency shelter, are employed. So it's not like they're not working and don't have some income. It's just that their income is not adequate to support them and or their family in safe, affordable housing. So it's very challenging for them to maintain housing. Our wages are low. Cost of housing is high, and that doesn't consider, you know, if you think about someone making minimum wage and then needing to pay $800 to $1,250 for rent, and then add the other expenses into that equation, child care, transportation, food, essential items. We're not talking about anything elaborate. It's very demanding, and the wages don't support those basic needs of a family.
And now you brought Anna with you, O'Neill. She is clearly much younger than all of us sitting here at this table. Is there something, anything that surprised you about the kind of situation that you're looking at in terms of people who are in need, whether they're homeless or just they just need food?
I did not realize the breadth and the variety of needs that we have in our community. When I started working for Diakonia as a volunteer, I understood the need for housing and people who were experiencing homelessness. But we see a lot of people who may not necessarily be homeless, but need a lot of help with making their budget work. Sometimes families take in other parts of the family so that a family of five might become a family of eight or nine. And suddenly they need the assistance of the food pantry to be able to feed everyone in the household. Their job didn't suddenly start paying them more money to support former people in their household. Mm-hmm. See people who have all different types of circumstances. So I had not realized that we had so many different types of struggles in our community on Delmarva. I am just entering the workforce, so right. I was used to sort of piecing together part-time jobs to make ends meet for myself, which is a household of one. So to imagine having to support other people, there isn't a lot of work here. There isn't a great variety of types of work. You know, there aren't manufacturing jobs in Ocean City. I've waited tables and known what it's like to look forward to January and not be sure how much money you'll make in that position. So I'm familiar with the challenges, and I understand how individuals or households can get into positions where suddenly the ends don't meet, and a service like what we're able to provide at Diakonia becomes essential.
Do you think that your generation is aware of this situation?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if my generation is very in touch with the issues and needs of the greater population, considering that we are starting families at a much older age. Not many of my friends have really established a household, like purchased a home, started to have kids. So I think that maybe our generation is a little less in touch with those struggles of, you know, making the paycheck last for what it needs to. And I have heard that we're a generous generation, that we do like to be involved and we're interested in helping other people. But I don't know if we're necessarily in touch with the inner workings of the causes of issues like homelessness and poverty.
Sister Virginia, so what are you seeing in terms of the people who are in need and the people that you serve? And has there been any change over the years, as I suggested to Claudia a moment ago? We've certainly looks like we're coming out of the recession. I think the unemployment rate is like 4.6%, for example, certainly down from 10% at one point. What are you seeing?
Well, I have to echo what these ladies have said. And I would also add that in our homeless room, what's consistent over the years, which doesn't seem to change with the economy, is that there are middle-aged men who have done mostly manual labor as youngsters, and they've become injured, and to the point maybe they can't quite get disability, but they cannot really handle the jobs that which are, I think, diminishing anyway, that younger men could do. I suspect they're passed over for construction jobs and things like that. So they end up with very spotty incomes and bad health. And they're not old enough yet to get Social Security. They're in their 50s. And that seems to be a pretty substantial chunk of the population that comes to Joseph House. We have also been seeing more families. The day shelter at the Joseph House is very crowded these days. And the families are just worrisome because I just worry about those little kids and what they're going to be doing as the weather gets cold. They might go from relative to relative, but housing is difficult. Mothers can't always figure out how to pay for it.
So do you think that what kind of impact do you think this has on the children? What kind of impact do you see just in the immediate sense?
Well, I can give one example. There's a young mother with two little kids. She herself was in the foster care system. She was raised in the foster system. And she said when she came of age, they kind of dropped her off at the Christian shelter and said goodbye. So I found that out because I was saying to her, do you have any support people? Do you have an aunt or a mother or a grandmother or somebody around? And she said, no, I'm a foster child myself. So one sad thing was her little three-year-old was in there getting a little restless, so I brought out the crayons and the paper, and I was drawing, and I drew a doggy and a kitty, and then I drew a house. And she just wanted me to draw a house over and over again, this little homeless girl.
Claudia, in terms of the fact that obviously we now paying attention not only because it's the holidays, but it's also because the weather is getting cold. What kind of impact does that have in terms of the trying to stay out of the cold, trying to keep to keep warm?
each community in our Tri-County area has some mechanism for a code blue or cold weather shelter. And that really is part of our planning process as a community together as partners to look at ways that we can open up very temporary shelters during the colder months to make sure that individuals aren't unsheltered and have a place to be. Some folks can stay outside or will stay outside or stay in more vulnerable kinds of locations when the weather is warmer. But once the weather and the temperatures start to drop, people tend to migrate in. The Salisbury area has a very well-established CESS program, which is a cold weather shelter that runs from January to March, where on those colder nights, people can come in and get some shelter. Ocean City is working on having one in the Worcester County area.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they were open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, because of the temperatures. So we work together as a team, providers across the community, or the faith community, nonprofits, and other providers in the community work to develop mechanisms for people so that they don't have to be outside in these colder temperatures. But that's very temporary. We don't have a lot of affordable housing options to get people housed, even when they have the resources to do that. So it's a challenging time. It's a wonderful time because people think about the spirit of the holiday season, giving. You see an uptick in terms of giving of food and gifts or whatever. Many of us as nonprofits and organizations serving the community have annual campaigns at this time of year to help reach out to the community and see, you know, engage potential donors who may help us to meet the costs of providing the services that we provide.
Anna, can you imagine not having a place to stay in the kind of cold weather that we're having right now?
Oh, not at all. And especially, you know, we operate out of West Ocean City, so there's lots of hotels and motels and things. But even just this week, I met a family who came to Diakonia who said, we're in a motel, but it's $280 a week. So you think about what that would cost you in a month, or if you were really in a dire situation, if you were unable to afford a shelter such as a hotel or a motel, people stay in their cars. And even that is incredibly unsafe, but at least that provides a minimal amount of shelter against the elements. There are people who will still stay outside even in the extreme weather. So it's really hard to imagine what that experience is like. I'm sure it's incredibly traumatic, and it really would do a number on your mental health to have to experience something like that. So, it's really hard to imagine what it would be like to experience not having a shelter or a place to go in the winter months.
Sister Virginia, give me a sense about what it is like or what people tell you it's like to be out here in the cold. They come in, they obviously get some assistance from you, maybe even a place to stay for a night, but it's only a matter of hours. It's not like they're going to be warm the entire time. What is that? What do they tell you it's like out there? I mean, what is that? I mean, give us a sense of what that is, because most of us are going to be going to their family dinners, and it's going to be warm, and we're going to be worried about warm food and so on and so forth. But that's a much different than, you know, looking out there and all you got is the cold weather.
Yes, they patch together their day. So they may, even if they are staying at the Halo shelter or the Christian shelter, they have to be out in the morning after breakfast. Then they sort of trudge over to Joseph House, for example, to our day shelter, which is open until 12:30. And there they can get breakfast, and we put on a movie, and they have a hot lunch. And then they have to leave. And often they'll go to the library. The library is so kind, the way they watch over. You know, they allow guys to and women to come in, and they they can go on the computer and look for work. A lot of them are learning how to look for work on the computer, day labor usually. But even we have a volunteer who's helping people who have gaps in their resumes to put together a resume and actually get steady work. And he's been rather successful. It's wonderful. So there really are ways to help. And thank God there are these different agencies like the library and shelters to do that for people. But then when they leave the library, then they can go have dinner at Halo. And if they're lucky enough to be staying at Halo, they can spend their night there. If they can't stay at Halo, then they go, they might be in a campsite or sleeping under the bridge in the warmer weather, and they're in danger of being chased away by the police or arrested. And in fact, there's a big push now in government agencies to adopt a housing first model. And the theory there is it's actually cheaper for the taxpayer to just find housing for people, to put more efforts into just getting housing for people and then bringing services to them, rather than kind of trying to find homeless people and get them services and do it all in this very ad hoc way. So there's some new efforts to, especially for the seriously mentally ill who have been on homeless for over a year. And some of those people have been coming to the Joseph House. So we're very glad about that. But it's an extremely insecure life. They're in danger of being robbed of their belongings. They often lose their sleeping bag or cell phone or clothing, and then they have to come to us and try to get more. So we welcome all donations. I just want to say warm wear, thermals, thermal pants, thermal shirts, hats, warm gloves. We've had a request for coveralls for some men who have to do very cold jobs in the winter, crawling into crawl spaces and things like that. We need blankets, those metallic blankets. We always need things like toothpaste, toothbrushes, deodorant. We need shoes and boots. I mean, some of these I know are expensive things, but if someone is able, backpacks. So we welcome any of those items for our people.
Claudia, I mean, we did a story actually a number of years back now in which our reporter walked around with a couple of homeless people, it's a woman and a man, and in the evening, pointing out where they stay, where you can like get either cheap food or cheap food that's thrown away. I recall, as a matter of fact, the woman in particular said, "Well, if I go to this, I guess it was a public restroom, there was a hose with water." She says that's where you can go ahead and clean up. I can imagine, like in a cold, but I mean, cold like this, to say nothing about the conditions, that's got to take a toll mentally on people when they have to go from place to place with that kind of insecurity.
One of the things that Diaconia strives to do is to work with folks, and treat them with respect and the dignity, because when they come to us and when we finally are able to connect, you know, some of the things just to survive that they've had to endure really chip away at that self concept. I don't want to say self-esteem. It's very demeaning. You know, you have to ask for assistance to feed yourself, to feed your family. You can't clean your clothes. You can't do some of those things. So, you know, what you or I would see as basics, folks may struggle to provide. So those are some of the ways, you know, that we reach out and help to get those basic needs met again, and then work with the individual to find their strength, identify that, and to begin to rebuild that sense of self that is lost when an individual or a family is in such a vulnerable position and really dependent upon the generosity and grace of a community to address their needs. So it's a building process, and it's not only about therapy. It's about kindness. It's about a cup of tea. It's about
friendship.
Mm-hmm. A new pair of socks.
Clothes so people don't shun them.
Mm-hmm.
Showers so that they smell good.
And just it's remarkable to me sometimes when I speak with our guests that stay at Diakonia, and they talk about how the kindness and grace that they are met with when they come was such a rewarding and renewing kind of event for them. And it gave them hope where they had lost hope or they were losing hope and feeling really poorly about their situation and depressed. And when you think about some of the situations that folks would endure, it's not even the chronically the folks who have had ongoing mental health issues, but just a short stint of that kind of deprivation is a serious blow to your sense of self, sense of well-being, and depression and anxiety is a natural response to the state of becoming homeless or being at risk, teetering on the brink of losing everything. And our society tells us that things are very important. And when you don't have things and you don't even have a place to put your things, it goes to the center of a person's identity.
Do the homeless bond with one another? I mean, do they? I mean, they're not just like individuals. I mean, do they? They have people who
yes.
They come, Virginia.
They do.
Virginia?
They do. Some of these guys have known each other for years. They've known each other's families, and this one fellow has suddenly become rather ill, and one of the other men was helping him get to his appointments and making sure that he went to the doctor, and they do. They do, and they're sort of subtle about it. You don't realize it at first. At first you think, gee, you know. But after a while, you begin to see the relationships and the alliances, and most of them just want to really have a peaceful life and get what they need and try to figure out what to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I think there's a lot of kindness that happens there. A lot of love, really.
We see in the housing program in particular, we have age range. You know, we have from 18 to 75 people who come in. And it's not just men. It's men and women. And families come in. And they begin. But one of the things that we try to do through our program is to give them a sense of what it means to build community. Because you or I may have an extended community of family, friends, people that we can reach out to for different things, friendship or assistance, and help our folks who come to us learn to build that, what it means to be part of a community, what it means to work together. And an opportunity for that, that's an opportunity for them to use some of the gifts that they have to be that person that they are and reach out. And we see some of the older guests reaching out and befriending some of our younger folks, sort of giving them some advice, support, you know, different family members working, you know, families working together. The group works together. But you have to make the environment a safe environment where the amount of vulnerability is reduced so that they can begin to reach out and rebuild those trusting relationships.
Let me say one final question, and that is, and I'm sure people will be asking this, is where are their families? I mean, but most of us have some kind of support of some fashion or another, brothers, sisters, or even parents are still around. What do they play any role? What's happened there? Claudia?
Well, in some cases, the families have experienced some of the same kinds of disparity that are the current folks are working with. So they may not be tightly connected. They may be loosely tethered and have their own struggles. They may have the folks who are with us may have had some issues that the family tried to help with, but then it's gotten to the point where the family can't help anymore, where they've cut ties. Because, you know, we didn't talk about this, but some of our folks do have substance issues, serious substance issues.
And mental health issues
that make it very difficult to manage behavior within a family environment. And you find that with individuals. And then you have the other part is, and I can't emphasize this enough, you may have a mom with two or three children, and her family can support X amount, but they can't do it all. So it's not, folks don't have a thick, a depth to their support. It's very thin and very stretched. So there's a number, and it happens. And they're not, it's local people, but they're issues that they've grappled with. Some family members just can't take it anymore.
It's not that different from middle-class families. If you've ever had a really difficult situation emerge, it's surprising how many of your relatives suddenly disappear.
It's true.
And we say, wait a minute, I thought you were going to help me with this. And everybody's really busy, or they're moving away, or they live far away. And that's the same with our people.
Uh-huh.
I became aware when my late husband got dementia that I really needed a team. I needed a real team. I needed a therapist. I needed a lawyer. I needed an accountant. I needed advisors. I really needed friends. And it's hard enough to get that team if you do have an income and a job. And but when you have no money, and as Claudia was saying, I'll say, Joe, can't you stay with a relative? And she'll say, they don't have any room for me. You know, they live in little places. They live in subsidized housing. They can't take on other people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's when a crisis hits, all of a sudden, everything seems to evaporate.
Well, we've been speaking with Sister Virginia. She's from Joseph's House. Also, Claudia Nagel. She's director of Diakonia, which provides housing, food, and counseling to those in need. Also working for Diakonia, Anna O'Neill. I appreciate you stopping by, and we'll keep everybody, I guess, in our thoughts and prayers.
Well, thank you so much, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas
Merry
to you,
Christmas
too.
Thank you for the opportunity. Happy holidays.
This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
In our world, ideas can be liturgy. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, generous conversation about the questions that matter most. What does it mean to be human? And how do we want to live? We explore with theologians, scientists, philosophers, thinkers, and activists every week from American Public Media.
Sunday mornings at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think, we feel.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
Infinite possibility and that sense of potential.
And we've had to refuse to fear failure.
You've got to persist through failure.
You can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSDL.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. I believe the more we know and understand about our world, the more fun it is to explore. We're all in the same traveler's school of hard knocks, and it's okay to share notes. Let's spend an hour together each week exploring the places and people that make our world so inviting. And we can share tips that help turn our travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality.
Saturday mornings at 7 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
In 1931, Salisbury convulsed with a mob who that day lynched Matthew Williams before burning his body for all to see, including the African-American community. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The lynching and the mob that day followed the arrest of Williams for allegedly shooting his employer. It was not enough to lynch and burn him, but the body was then dragged through the streets of downtown Salisbury in a fury of violence the city has not seen since. 85 years later, a small group called Show Up for Racial Justice Delmarva held a candlelight vigil calling attention to the event, and it comes at a time when many Americans feel that the racial divide in the country has widened despite the election of the nation's first black president. In our studio this morning is James Yamakawa and also Amber Green, both co-founders of Racial Justice Delmarvin. Welcome to the program, first of all.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, well, tell me then a little bit about, let's talk a little bit about the vigil first. Why you thought it was important to have this vigil and what kind of response you feel that that you got from it?
Well, it was important because it's part of our community's history, and it's a part that has been kind of swept under the rug and kept quiet for very long. I mean, there are stories floating around. Families tell stories, pass it on to their children, some good, some bad. This is one of those ones that has been kept quiet for very, very long, and it needed to come to light.
Mm. Amber, what about you? What motivated you to say, you know, we got to bring this thing forward again? I mean, I've heard stories and I've read the histories, and we actually did a piece on Georgetown, which was the African American community actually at the time there, which has now been, of course, washed away by development. How did you become involved in all of this?
Well, in addition to being a supporter of Serge Delmarva, I'm also a co-founder of Phoenix Youth Project Incorporated. And we're a youth organization where our mission is to empower youth to get involved in the local communities, get involved in civic engagement, and just have a say in what's going on. And so this opportunity for the youth today to see that the past is a learning tool. And so we're learning from our past to know this can't happen again. And we're looking towards our future. And so how I got involved is just I saw this as an opportunity to get youth involved and to get youth to know their local history, because a lot of kids here didn't even know that that happened in their town, and a lot of adults as well. And so I thought this was important for the local community to know their history and to know that this is where they were, but this is not where they're going.
Amber, how did you become aware of this event in the first place?
Well, I'm friends with James, and so he shared with me his ideas and his plans, and I totally was motivated to support him, advise him in different things, and I was really just motivated to help and support him and what he was doing.
Were you shocked when you heard about this story?
No, I wasn't. When I got here in 2008 to attend University of Maryland Eastern Shore, I hear the scary stories of when you come to the Eastern Shore. You know, it's almost like going down south and just going across the bridge. And so I was prepared. And so I learned most of the Eastern Shore history over in the DMV area and in Baltimore. I went to the Baltimore Black and Wax Museum. And so there's a whole floor dedicated to the Eastern Shore. And so that's why I learned the history. And so when I come over here and I talk with the youth and I talk with different adults and they don't know their own history, it kind of amazed me. But I found out by just reading and internet and museums over on another side on the bridge.
Yeah, James, what about you? I mean, how did you run across this and what was your reaction to the fact this happened downtown and in places where, as I think we talked earlier, places you've walked by probably many times?
It was a bit of a shock. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I knew something had happened because it was a couple years back. There was a vigil for Freddie Gray downtown. Right. And someone had mentioned something about someone being lynched on one of the trees there. And I was like, huh. And so I started looking into it. And right. Eventually that became to this. It was a shock. I mean, like just the fact that you can actually walk by the exact spot where this happened. And not like 100 feet from there, there is a sign for a Confederate Civil War general. It's kind of one of those images that is like, you know, doesn't sit right for anyone. That like, you know, that could be there and nothing for this one guy that was lynched by a white mob.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that many people are aware of this event in this community?
I think more are aware than they would than probably are willing to say.
Mm.
But I also think that to some extent it's kept quiet for a reason to basically like whitewash the past. Like, you know, this stuff just can't happen now. So like, you know, so the people like keep it quiet so that we don't have to come to grips and come to terms with that past. But if like, you know, someone were to bring it up, then it would risk breaking that silence.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember a little bit too. Are you surprised at what seems to be, I don't know, the silence exactly, but it's certainly not talked about a great deal. For instance, we did a couple of years ago, we did a story about the Georgetown area and how it kind of just like disappeared. And I know there were efforts, I think with Shaney Shields, who was on the city council at one point, which told me she would have liked to have had some kind of sign for that particular community. It didn't happen. There was resistance to it. What do you make of that resistance to recognizing this history that we have here?
I feel as though when you don't acknowledge someone's pain and it's still a fresh wound that keeps getting reopened every time they turn on a TV and they look at the news, it's a fresh wound being reopened and lashed open every time you see a Black man being shot by a police officer, or when you see a Black woman being dragged across the street, or hear stories that are just frightening, even in your local community. I think it's an insult. And as a fellow community activist has said not too long ago, it makes you feel not valued at all as an individual, as a Black American, and definitely as a Black male American. And to know that there are stories that need to be told, to know that there are, you know, consequences that need to be given out and it's not happening, and to repeatedly see and be reminded that you're not valued, I think it is an insult. And so I really believe that if Salisbury, this community, want to move forward and want to unite Salisbury, unite the Eastern Shore, I think it is time to acknowledge the pain that has happened in our community. It is time to say, hey, I know this happened, and this is not we're not that anymore. We're something different. Acknowledge the fact that there are reasons why people are scared. There's a reason why people are angry. There's a reason for this, and it's experience that backs it up. And so I definitely feel like it's time for this history to be unveiled, because it's a lot of wounds that need to be healed.
Do you see a connection then between this event in 1931 and the kind of current atmosphere that we see today?
I personally feel as though it's not as bad as it was. But I always personally think that if we haven't come this far just to only go this far, we have a lot of work to do. And specifically on the Eastern Shore, we have a lot of work to do because of the silence. And I think that silence fuels the fire. It's like a silent gas that is just toxic. And, I feel as though, you know, relations have gotten better, but in Salisbury in itself, but I can drive 15 minutes down the 13 and feel as though I'm a third rate citizen. And I've experienced that 4 or 5 years of my life attending a historically Black college.
Are there specific incidents that have made you feel that way? Or is it just an atmosphere that you feel that way? It's an
atmosphere, but there definitely are personal incidents or, you know, experiences that friends that have shared about their experience. But the atmosphere in itself, there's work to do. Right now there's a lot of tension in the air that you can just cut with a knife. There's a lot of tension in the air. But I'm eager to see what's going to happen, because right now, you have a lot of individuals unsure of what to do, what to think, what to say. And so they're out here in the world not being led, especially the young community, the youth. Just when our president-elect was selected and, you know, schools were being, students were walking out and saying, no, I don't want this. And that was a sign of, okay, this is a new generation. This is a new generation that needs to be led. This is a new generation that needs direction, but they know what they want clearly, and we have to listen to them. And they're screaming, they're crying out for you to pay attention. So I'm eager to see what's next for Salisbury and what's next for the United States.
Well, we've been speaking with James Yamakawa. He is co-founder of Racial Justice Delmarva, also co-founder, also Amber Green, who's also, and your group again, your founding group
I am co-founder and executive director of Phoenix Youth Project Incorporated. Okay.
And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this. And now we're going to take a look at actually the history involved in this particular incident. Well, now I want to turn to Linda Dwyer. She's not only written about the lynching, but has also interviewed at least one person who passed through the crowd that night. She's also author of Mob Law on Delmarva. And welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you were actually at the vigil the other night. You didn't march, but rather you saw the marchers come down the street.
Yes.
What sense do you have about that? Because this is the same street in which this event occurred.
Well, I elected not to do the walking part due to bad knees. And I, you know, arrived at the site of the courthouse. And I watched as the crowd appeared on Division Street and then made, crossed over onto Main Street and was coming at me towards the courthouse. And they were sort of silhouetted against the few lights that were there, slow, quiet, respectful, carrying very little candles. And but I suddenly got a chill watching them come towards me, because I kept imagining quite a different scene, you know, 85 years ago, because that would have been the route that the mob took, probably pushing Matthew Williams or dragging or shoving and screaming and hollering, coming towards the courthouse in the same direction. And it kind of moved me to see this quite different type of crowd who was coming as a vigil for the same man.
Mm-hmm. So let's begin with, how did this event start out in terms of Williams? I mean, he was accused at one point of shooting his employer.
Yes, and it happened on a Friday. He was not scheduled to go to work, according to reports, but he did go into the office, the Daniel Elliott Box and Crate Factory office building was on Lake Street, about little north of where the Route 50 bridge is, goes across on the west side of the river. And it's a very tiny building. I've seen photos of this building. And he went in. Why, you know, they didn't say. But it was a Friday. He wasn't scheduled to work. So my opinion is that he probably went in, maybe to get his pay. There was reports that he worked odd jobs at the home of Daniel Elliott, who he was accused of killing. He may have been trying to see if there was any work for him on the weekend. I don't know. But he went in the afternoon onto the office, and what happened in that office, no one can really say at this point. There were witnesses, though. There was a black laborer in the back who was there, who was quoted, not as seeing anything. Daniel Elliott's secretary was in the next room. And, of course, Daniel's son was in there, too. And so was Matthew Williams. Daniel was shot. Reportedly, he was on the phone. He was shot in the head. He was on the phone to one of his clients, and he was shot in the head. Apparently, Matthew Williams ran out into the lumber yard. There's lumber outside of this little building. They say self-inflicted wound. You know, whatever the case, he was taken to the hospital. All in this afternoon, the Salisbury Times, now the Daily Times, the Salisbury Times newspaper office was on Main Street in the plaza area at the time. And they posted two announcements. The first announcement was wrong, and there was a crowd gathering. Apparently, the people already knew what had happened and that Matthew Williams was accused of having done this crime. And people were milling about at the news office, and they posted an announcement saying that Matthew Williams was dead. And one person was quoted as saying, ah, it's a shame. We were going to have some fun tonight. This was quoted in a newspaper. And a few minutes later, they reposted another announcement to say they were wrong, that Matthew Williams was in the hospital. And it's that all of a sudden the mob decided that let's go get him. So they walked up Division Street to the hospital. They were denied access into the hospital, but they went around to the side of the hospital. The male colored ward was on the first floor. They went in a window, grabbed him from there, and took him out. He was apparently in a straitjacket, and his head was bandaged, and I don't know why, for both. But he was dragged or pushed and walked down Division Street. Apparently on the way to the hospital, they ducked into the firehouse, now Headquarters Live,
right?
For some rope. And someone asked me if I thought Matthew Williams was dead before he was hung by the tree on the courthouse lawn. And I think not. I think he was fully aware, if not semi-conscious. The only reason I say that is I was told that, given a description of a white man prominent, whose name I did not know, in Salisbury, on the way, he kicked Matthew Williams so that he had to fall to the ground. So it evidenced that he was, you know, at least walking part of the way.
Yeah.
I went to the courthouse lawn. How big the crowd it is varies depending on the accounts. One says 2,000, one says 1,000. I can't even imagine 1,000 people in that area anyway, but it's quite possible. And he was strung up on the courthouse lawn, at the tree on the Main Street side.
Is there some sense about who was in the crowd at this point?
I don't have a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You mean white versus?
Yeah, the whites, yeah.
There were whites. There were blacks who were hurrying back to their homes once they saw what was happening. The Afro-American newspaper had an account by a Mr. Nelson, who was a black man who happened to be in town on business. And he was quoted. He gave us an account of what happened because he could pass for white. And so he was there when the newspaper announcements came up, and he had a great description. I've heard that some others were there that were black to witness, but right. I don't know. It's all mostly a white crowd.
What was his description like?
Kind of just what I had said about the newspaper being announcements and about the man saying, oh, it's a shame. Because we were going to have some fun tonight. And he said, it's just all of a sudden someone said, let's go get him. And that's basically what he said. He had more to say.
So at this point, they hang him at the tree. What transpires after this and where they're going?
I had one account from a Mr. Howard Purnell. He said he was pulled up and down a few times on that tree. And then after that, they took him down and they dragged him east along Main Street, down Main Street. A lot of people think that he was dragged immediately to the west side along Main Street, but that's not true because many people aren't aware that there had been a black neighborhood at that time, starting only a couple of blocks away, called Georgetown. And, they dragged the body down the street to Poplar Hill Avenue, turned left a short distance to a small vacant lot on the right, which right now is sort of the entrance to the municipal parking lot where the flea markets are held on the weekends. Nearby was a two-story garage for buses, and that's where they went in to get, you know, with reportedly 40 or 50 or 60 gallons of gasoline. They would have had it enough for that. And there's only one account, and that's the Baltimore Afro-American, of someone saying that there was mutilation of the body before the body was burned and supposedly tossed onto the yards of some of the blacks living nearby. They were only yards away from the black Baptist church and a few other residential homes. So they definitely did this on purpose to scare the black community. And then they doused him and burned the body for quite a while. Then that wasn't enough. They dragged his charred body, up along Main Street again, back up past the courthouse, all the way for the length of Main Street, down the plaza area that we know, all the way to the bridge. A few blacks were trying to get out of the way. One was reported to have jumped into the river, and others were trying to get out of the way. They went across the bridge, and at the corner of Lake Street, there was a lamppost, and they tied his body to that lamppost. And eventually, he was taken down. And his body was eventually at James Stewart's funeral home, a black undertaker at that time. His business was directly across the street from what is now the Chipman Cultural Center,
mm-hmm.
then the John Wesley Church. Matthew Williams was taken care of there. His funeral was at the John Wesley Church, and he was buried in the Houston Cemetery east of the railroad track. Trying to think of anything else you want to know.
Well, in terms of you mentioned Mr. Purnell. Describe what his tale was like. What happened to him as he moved, obviously, to get out of the way, and what happened?
I had met him through a history discussion group when I was trying to learn about the history of Georgetown, and I had met him. He started coming to my meetings, and never brought up the subject of the lynching because it wasn't my place. Wasn't my purpose either. I was trying to learn about the neighborhood. If anyone wanted to bring it up, that's fine. But my rule was that I wasn't going to bring up all the negativity. But I broke my rule. But it was at the end of one meeting, and I had only known or met him once and before. And he and James Jolly were getting up to go to the door to leave. And I was seated down, and I said I couldn't resist. I knew that he had been he worked at the Wicomico Hotel, which was across from the courthouse. And so I asked him where he was on December 4th, 1931. And he just stopped in his tracks, and he said he was there, and he saw it, and it had been his mother's birthday. He told me that, contrary to what's written elsewhere, he was not working that night at the Wicomico Hotel. He normally would have, but by that time the lynching was at night. And he instead had changed his hours to go see a movie. I'm not sure which movie theater, but it was right on Main Street in the plaza area. And word was circulating that what was going on outside, and everyone was leaving. And I've mentioned before, I always assumed that the blacks in the area, and I assumed that had been a segregated movie theater, were rushing to the west side to go home. But he lived in the Georgetown area, and he had to go right past the mob to get home. He had to go towards it anyway. So instead of going straight down Main Street to his house, he went to the corner. He could hear his classmate being strung up several times, and he turned left and went down Church Street to his home, his parents' home, where he was living. Howard Purnell was a classmate, and Howard would have been the same age, about the same age, as this man being lynched. And he seldom talked about it, and I was surprised that he talked to me about it. He didn't go into any much more detail except for the fact that when he was at his parents' house, he found his father upstairs at the window with a shotgun looking out, because from that vantage, they could see the body being burned. And there was real fear that, the mobs would get out of hand and go into the Black community. I've heard this time and again. For example, on the West Side, someone told me that their family quickly drew the shades and turned out the lights. You know, that kind of thing.
What kind of impact did this have then on the community in terms of its aftermath? Is there any sense about whether people talked about it? Obviously, there are people who, both, you know, for instance, African Americans who went into white homes who have been working there. Probably some people who might have either watched or participated. And did it have a longer impact, do you think, on that part of the city?
I would imagine. It's hard to imagine what it was like, you know, how terrifying it must be to deal with people on a day-to-day basis after that, especially if they knew who the mob members were or simply who came to witness the lynching. This Georgetown area was so tucked into downtown and Newtown. Blacks and whites lived across the street from each other at one point. I can't imagine what that was like for both sides. I always feel as if it was even more uncomfortable for Georgetown, the people of Georgetown, Black and their neighbors, their white neighbors, to be in each other's presence after that. But that's just my thinking. It's hard to imagine what it would have been like. In short order, though, that was 1931, almost 32. In short order, things happened so that fairly quickly that neighborhood disappeared bit by bit. And I think that was on purpose. And there's very few remnants of that Georgetown neighborhood. It seemed to have deeply divided the town geographically at that time. Pockets of Black and white in Salisbury. And shortly after that, things changed so that the Blacks were steered to the West Side.
Looking at today, do you think that Salisburyans have any sense about what happened? Obviously, there are people who have family members who certainly were around at the time. What sense do you get about this city and whether it comes to grips with that event? Because we still, for instance, Princess Anne, for instance, marked a lynching that occurred a couple of years after that.
Princess Anne lynching was in 33. You should also know that at that 33 lynching of Princess Anne, accused members of the mobs were arrested and taken to Baltimore, but they were brought to Salisbury first. And there was a massive riot here in Salisbury, of which Salisburyans participated.
Mm.
So things were still ripe after the Matthew Williams lynching. Some people still get them confused. They think the rioting happened after the Matthew Williams, but no one was arrested for the Matthew Williams lynching. And another interesting thing is that right after the lynching, there was a good reason to quickly hush the whole thing. There were many good reasons, the natural ones.
Sure.
You know, and
right.
Not talking about it. Don't accuse anybody. But 1932, this was 31 in December. And in 32, they had an inquest, you know, it amounted to nothing. And 1932 was the bicentennial year for Salisbury. Salisbury was founded in 1732. And so the entire 1932 was spent making arrangements for the pageantry, the inviting the Salisbury from Salisbury, England, the dignitary from Salisbury, England, to have big parades and all kinds of events that were held later that year. So I feel as if there was more incentive to keep everything hushed in that particular year. I recently found several photographs of the pageantry during their celebration of the bicentennial in downtown Salisbury, the grandstand where the dignitaries were and the parade went by, it was the same sight on the Main Street side of the courthouse, right below the tree. And it kind of stunned me there when I saw it, you know.
Oh, gosh.
So who's to say? I feel that I think Eastern Shore in general has gotten had a reputation as being a violent place, a very racist place, dangerous place to be. And that's particularly true of Salisbury. The aftermath? You know, what's the question again? I mean,
and people don't talk about it.
People don't talk. They still don't talk about it. This, about a few years back, I was part of a public event in Princess Anne at UMES with a whole panel discussion of all the people, the real knowledgeable people about the George Armwood lynching, mm-hmm. including Sherrilyn Ifill, who was there, who had written on the courthouse lawn. And a lot of people feel as if Princess Anne is backwards, but they were the first to have any public event acknowledging their lynching. They didn't have a vigil. They almost did, but they canceled that. So it's taken this long for Salisbury to even have a public event. And there may even be silence to continue, you know, not discuss it any further. It's over with. I know that the lynching had an effect on the black community because the people were telling me how they just couldn't talk about it. It was in fear for their, not only their lives, but their livelihoods and their families and that sort of thing.
We've been speaking with Linda Dwyer, as she has written extensively about the lynching and the history, particularly in here in Salisbury, including the book Mob Law on Delmarva. Earlier in this hour, we also talked with James Yamakawa. He's co-founder of Racial Justice Delmarva, who organized the protests, the vigil the other evening. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.